It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
Duck carving on the Eastern Shore has become world-renowned, but it started as a very practical way of making a living. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Decoys to attract waterfowl reach back to Native Americans, even before the arrival of Europeans to the Eastern Shore. And at the time settlers showed up here, it is said that the sky could be blackened with the flight of birds. The decoys became more than just a way of life. It also became an art form. Here on the Eastern Shore, the Ward brothers took a keen interest in duck carving, producing estimated 25,000 pieces over 50 years. This morning, we want to take a look at that tradition. In our studio this morning is Laura Botanelli. She's the executive director of the Ward Museum of Waterfowl Art. It's also part of Salisbury University. Also, two carvers, David Bennett Scott, who grew up in Berlin, and also Rich Smoker, who originally grew up on the Susquehanna River in Pennsylvania and moved to Marion Station near Crisfield in 1982. And welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So I want to actually begin with the passing of the legendary carver, Delbert Cigar Daisy. Start with you, Laura. Tell us a little bit about him. And by the way, how did he pick up the name Cigar?
Well, Cigar is like one of the great heroes and legends of the decoy carving community and lived right down in Chincoteague, Virginia, just down the road from us. And the story on his name, Cigar, was during a time when he was out in the marsh and he had been baiting birds. And his telltale cigar had fallen out of his pocket and was left behind and was found by one of the natural resource managers, and then he was caught. So, but he is, apart from that tale, was known nationally and internationally as sort of one of the great American decoy makers, definitely of the same status as the Ward brothers, and he, you know, just passed away a few weeks ago.
Was there something particularly characteristic, do you think, about his work?
I'm going to turn to my fellow carvers today.
Okay, what about that? What about his work?
His work was very stylish for his own use. It was all utilitarian, and he took that utilitarian idea and prefaced it into an art form of his very own. He did things that other people in Chincoteague were not doing and around the country were not doing also. And it's really brought him to the forefront of carving in that time period.
Well, his style and distinctive carving that he had, you know, was easily separated from all the others there, like say on Chincoteague and many of us in the carving world. Cigar had a wonderful hands-on knowledge with all the birds and nature in general. And when you talk to Cigar, you could learn something every time you talk to him about the different characteristics, what they did, what they didn't do, what they could and what they couldn't do. And he incorporated that in his carvings, which made his carvings so nice.
So, Laura, this is obviously duck carving has been a long tradition, and it was a very practical thing at one point. Give some sense of history as to the development of this particular art form, which really began as a way to simply he got a living.
Very true. So, these guys will attest it's pretty easy to fool a duck.
and not all the time.
So, whether you were early Native American traditions may not have even been wooden decoys. They may have been, you know, humps of marsh mud or something like that that were able to lure in birds. So as the ability to carve and produce decoys improved as settlement in the United States came together and the demand for birds became more intense, the decoy moved right along with its sophistication and the styles that were developed from in the different corners of the country. But your question was
about the history. I mean, how did it develop? I mean, and what were they using them for? And I understand that obviously wooden ducks in terms of using them actually kind of phased out. But what initially was that like? And what kind of weapons did they use? What kind of techniques did they use?
Well, again, I'm going to pass it over to the guys that are actually out there in the marsh and doing this work. We got them right here.
Well, the thing that helped establish the decoy carving was they outlawed live decoys. So before there was a time in history, you know, when you could actually use live birds to lure, you know, the wild birds into your gun range or whatever, you know. And once that was outlawed, then you needed something to entice the birds to come. You couldn't use the live decoys anymore, so you made facsimiles that simulated the species that you were trying to cover, the ones that were frequent in your area. So that was part of it, I think.
A lot of it started way back when it was market gunning, pure market gunning for the public. I've handled decoys as early as 1840, 1850, and these were all used as a tool to feed the masses. And they would have anywhere from, 400, 500, 1,000 decoys that they would use at a time, to lure decoys. Bennett was correct with using live decoys, but I think the market hunting predates that, too, with all the decoys. And most of the decoys were made by hand, of course, with either hatchets, draw knives, and spokeshaves, knives, that sort of thing. There wasn't any power tools. A lot of them were cut out with coping saws, the bodies, and or just cut off of a log and then hand-chopped to realize the forms that they were after.
So as that change from market gunning also became outlawed, mm-hmm. You couldn't sell wild game meat at the market, that there was this shift towards more recreational hunting and gunning clubs. And the carver who was carving the decoy kind of moved right along with it, whether they had been guiding as part of or working as market gunners and shifting over to guide work. And then the decoys themselves just moved right along with the hunting practice at the time. I'm always really fascinated by the different regional styles of birds, is that birds that were carved in different parts of the country have distinct looks for very specific reasons. Now, other woodworking has this, like furniture making. You may be familiar with like the Boston style of furniture making or something like that. But for decoys, it's even more important layer is that those regional styles were very much related to the environment in which the bird was being used for hunting. Whether you're in, a more coastal environment with sort of rougher waters, or if you're on a river environment where the bird would be carved differently in order to respond to that particular hunting condition. And, Rich is a pretty knowledgeable on the decoys of the lower Chesapeake Bay, who have their own distinct style, mm-hmm. which I know you work
what about
hard.
That? Yeah. What
about Chesapeake, it changes style so much. When you enter the bay at the top on the Susquehanna Flats, you have a lot of decoys that are rounded bottoms and solid to handle the short, choppy waves that are up there and the currents. As you move down the bay, we transpose them into flat bottom decoys. Till you finally get into Crisfield area, and you have decoys that were evolved into real wide hips, flat bottom, real wide hips, and a real narrow chest to handle the short, choppy waves of the lower Chesapeake. And then as you go further south through Virginia, you run into more rounded decoys again. A lot of the rounded decoys in Virginia are originally from the impetus of those was from New Jersey. New Jersey scout sports would come down here in their sailing craft, and they would have gunning clubs up and down the eastern shore of Virginia, and they would bring their decoys from New Jersey. So the style was incorporated into the New Jersey decoys, from the New Jersey decoys into Virginia decoys, whereas Crisfield kind of grew by itself, being cut off from the rest of the world, so to speak.
Now, in terms of species of birds, what obviously different parts of the country have different kinds of birds. Mm-hmm. What was the emphasis here? I mean, was it simply on geese, or what kind of
meat and taters?
Meat and taters.
Canvasbacks, black ducks, pintails, widgeon, blackheads, scalp, if you will, and redheads. You'll find a lot of those. Well, we didn't have a lot of geese way back when, until they really started farming for grains, small grains, and then we started picking up more geese. Bennett can attest to that because he's hunted here forever.
Thank you, Rich. I have been a good while, but that is true. And then at one time, I think the Carolinas had all the geese, and then they come into the Maryland area because of, like Rich is saying, the farming practices and things like that. Then up in New Jersey, the truck crops, I call them, kind of went by the wayside, and then small grains come up there, and then it was getting to be difficult to get the geese as they migrated below New Jersey. So, but that he was right on, as far as how they would do. And the birds area, of course, the Chesapeake Bay is one of our crown jewels, and that's where those bay ducks were. And the river, and also the bay ducks required larger numbers of decoys to lure them because they were, you know, in the open bays and all. You know, you could put out hundreds of canvasbacks and redheads and bluebills and things like that, you know, and then you fall back into marshes around Chrisfield and all, half dozen black ducks might be all you need.
I hunted with a friend in Virginia one time, and he had a boatload of decoys, and he just requested us to put them out until you get tired.
As these guys were talking, you maybe heard some species names that maybe didn't ring true with maybe what you remember reading in a book. So there's a lot of vernacular names for the ducks around here.
That's the truth, too. Uh-huh.
So I'm sure we could just go over a few of the high points on those.
Yeah, we start talking about wadgets and all kinds of stuff. Yeah. Oh, amazing.
But like canvasback is known as a few things.
Yeah, well, generally just cans. Mm-hmm. You know, redheads are just redheads. The scalp were always blackheads that I knew of. Mm-hmm.
Well, they call I have a bird carved by Lem and Steve that have all the local names for the greater scalp on it, and it was big blackhead, blackheads, big bay duck. You know, that's what and naturally greater scalp was the proper name. But a lot of them get different names: widgeons, American widgeons, ball.
What are American widgeons?
American widgeons is the puddle duck.
Mm-hmm. A puddle duck.
Crown.
Had a white crown on the head, and thereby got the name of ball pates because mm-hmm. white streak down the top of her head looked like there wasn't anything there, I guess.
Ball crown.
And ball crown, ball pates.
I remember when I first moved down here way back when, and somebody was talking to me about shooting pheasants. You know, I grew up in Pennsylvania hunting pheasants, and I thought, wow, this is great. We're going to have pheasants again. And there are red-breasted mergansers down here, you know. So I started looking into it. Red-breasted mergansers for pheasants. Hooded mergansers were hairy heads. And then you run into common mergansers or the American mergansers, and those are wadgets. Mm-hmm. You know, I need a whole new book.
Yep.
But it's kind of fun.
It sounds like the part. It just sounds like there's a slew. I mean, when we look out, I mean, mm-hmm. obviously, now we see geese, but I don't think most people are aware that there are that's kind of variety out there of birds. I mean,
all you got to do is spend a day in the marsh. I mean, that's the beauty of right now. I'm turkey hunting, and not so much. I don't care about the turkeys that much, even though I do. But it's just seeing the birds that are there. You know, I mean, I saw all kinds of warblers today, and you know, it's if you can get outside and just open your eyes to what's there. There's a whole world out there. I mean, it's not going to the mall.
So now, obviously, these ducks were very practical things. How did it come to the point where you're moving away from something that's very practical as opposed to, say, something that's now artistic? As a matter of fact, I ran across a quote from Laura here. Which said that, quote, the tool starts getting fancier because it's trying to impress people rather than do the job the tool was meant to do.
Sure.
Wow. You said that?
I guess I did.
Wow. I got that quote right there.
Yeah.
So how did that come about? What does this change? Obviously, the Ward folks have a good deal to do with that as well.
Well, one of the big parts of that story is decoy competition. So for several hundred years, people have been coming together, floating their ducks next to one another and finding out who can make the best decoy. And that's as a tool. But you do that over and over again, and it's the human tendency to make things more beautiful, right? And if it's trying to show a human who's made the best bird, well, maybe it's not what can fool the duck the best. It's what looks the best, which is, you know, whether it's highly refined with its painting or it has additional flourishes with the carving. And so keep doing that over and over, and you start to see what, as you go into the Ward Museum, the finely decorative works that we have on display there. But, you know, it's even a strictly working hunting bird can be quite beautiful. It has a lot of things going on it.
Simplistic.
That is mm-hmm. not, maybe not about fooling the bird, but it's about the maker and mm-hmm. mostly his desire to be able to make a finely crafted tool. Now, you guys both do decorative works and decoys.
I'll go your one better, I think, with the old decoy makers. It's not so much to impress somebody else. It's a natural progression. Mm-hmm. They wanted to do art. They felt as though, you know, just sculpting a decoy, which is what they were doing, is not the end result. They want to really impress somebody or impress themselves and bring out their inner artist.
And Lim and a few others were, the board were, and a few others were great at that. You look at bird in a natural position, floating in the water, you don't see the speculum. That's a little color patch of the secondary feathers that mostly blues or greens or something like that. But they started incorporating those in their work, and that's what put the wards in my book a step ahead of the other, you know, of most of the other carvers that were in the area. However, there were a few of the Elmer Kroll people like that, you know, that were doing that, you know, in the early years. I can't remember. I don't know what the dates would be for them. Yeah. Rich probably can help me there. But
you said Elmer.
Those things you keep, you know, they keep doing and just keep, and they get, like Laura said, you know, you had your working decoy. Well, you're putting it there with the best. So then they're going to start incorporating little things that make them more attractive. And a lot of time the things that I do to my birds are really not for the benefit of luring a duck, but for creating, for attracting customers.
When you said Elmer Kroll, brings to mind back when he was making decoys at the turn of the century, he wanted to improve his painting, so he went to a professional artist and had his parents at the time pay him a dollar a session to go in and learn how to paint. And I forget, and at that time it was a tidy sum, you know, to learn how to paint decoys, and of which he is noted for that now. Mm-hmm. Not so much his form sometimes, but his painting is just phenomenal.
Absolutely.
And just like Bennett said, the fellows who really were able to put more paint on something and be able to manipulate it and make it look like the bird, Ward mm-hmm. Brother, Cigar Daisy, Ira Hudson, all of those guys. I mean, those birds are really collectible now.
And the early carvers, they had these incredible woodworking abilities that weren't just being used to make decoys. You know, maybe they were boat builders, maybe they were doing other type of fine woodworking. But when they went and applied their skills to decoy making, it was at the highest level that they could achieve. But some of the greatest artifacts that we have at the museum are some of the early decoratives by some of the older makers. And maybe they were carved as gifts to family members. And so that family member... there's a particular set of birds, it's a mallard family by Ira Hudson. It was a gift to his daughter for Christmas. Mm-hmm. And so the birds, the hen has her wings up and it has a bunch of little ducklings underneath of it. And obviously that's not a decoy. It's not a working decoy. But you can see right at the heart of it that these really famous Ira Hudson working decoys are basically based in that beautiful piece of art that he made for his daughter. And it was meant to be put on, you know, for her enjoyment and display. So, you know, none of this is happening in a vacuum. So these skills that, whether it was older makers or contemporary makers have, they are, you know, coming out in all different ways.
And I understand, by the way, that in terms of wooden decoys as something that's used to go hunting, that's basically disappeared, as I understand. Plastics and so on have come to replace them.
Disappears probably a little heavy. Yeah,
I don't agree with that.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
You know, the logistics of it were when you're carrying a dozen decoys and they were solid wood. You know, obviously it would be easier to carry a dozen decoys that were hollow plastic.
Right.
And a lot of people like that, but I have found a resurgence in decoy making. People really want to learn how to do it, and you know, I make quite a few rigs for people over the course of years. That people hunt with them. And I know Bennett does the same.
Yeah, I'm making a rig now, you know, have it started. Been a long time getting it done, but I'm making a rig for my son, you know, and we've hunted over them, and actually it's more pleasure than hunting over the plastics. And now, to help bring that along, the boats we got now and the places we can get to with them are making it easier to go back again and carry our wooden blocks, as we call them.
True.
You call your decoys wooden blocks?
Yep. Yeah, well, that's what they call them, blocks and stools.
I'm trying to bring back Ward Brother decoys to where I live on the Big Animesic River. It's been probably 50 years since Ward decoys have floated there, and I'm making a rig of decoys just out of Ward Brother patterns just to hunt there. but I'm making them a little bit more modern so that they float better.
Mm-hmm. So, David, I want to turn to you and tell me a little bit of how you got involved with carving in the first place.
With carving?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
I've got my first pair of birds that I made was done in '68, and I've been carving ever since. But for me to get into it, I went to an early Ward show. That's before the Civic Center, and when the old Civic Center was here in Salisbury, before it burned, and went around there with my mouth hanging open and saw these guys, saw J.B. Garton, for one, from Canada, and he had a little sign on his table there, you know. Everything was made out of wood and painted with acrylics, and that I thought, well, you know, I ought to be able to do this, and I just went back and kept trying, kept trying. One thing I would like to bring out, too, I think there's basically three classes of carving. One is the working decoy, and then the decoratives, and then the realistics. And if you go to the world competition here, you'll see just how close that people are coming to actually duplicating God's work. It's just a frozen moment in time that that they select, and I mean, the techniques and stuff are just, I'll wait each year at the competition to see what's new, what's going to happen this year. So those are things. But
Rich, you actually, as I mentioned a moment ago, grew up at the Susquehanna River. Mm-hmm. But your encounter with birds wasn't really carving at all. It was taxidermy?
Well, actually, it was decoys to begin with.
Decoys? Okay. Yeah.
I started carving birds with my father, who was an industrial arts teacher in the high school. And I would steal away from classes and get down, and we'd make decoys. With mine, it was the same time Bennett started, too, in the late 60s. I did it for the idea that I wanted to hunt ducks, but I also liked to work with my hands and build things out of wood. So consequently, it went that way. While I was carving, I figured I needed to learn more about the anatomy of birds, so I ended up apprenticing with a man for learning taxidermy in a studio up there where we did a lot of work from all over the world. And I worked with him for 9 years and still kept carving. So I did learn. I have a good handle on anatomy and also birds of the world.
So. It was, anything in particular do you think you learned from that experience at taxidermy that might make you give you maybe cut above someone
else?
Well,
with taxidermy, I think it helps. With taxidermy, you have to go from the inside out, and with wood carving, you go from the outside in. If I know what the inside looks like, I know how to get there from the outside. So I think that's takes a lot of years off the learning curve. You know, I teach quite a few classes during the course of the year, and the hardest thing is to teach people anatomy, which you cannot do. You have to study it.
So what is it like to carve wood? I mean, what is that experience like? Wait, is there
depending
frustration
on the piece
or
of wood?
Are you even aware of what's going on around you when you're doing it? What is that like?
Yeah, well, I've been doing so much I can do two things at once. I can talk and carve, you know, at the same time, you know. So, but yeah, you know, and I've found over the years I've changed my preference in woods. You know, today I use Tupelo. And it's because I make decorative pieces mostly, life-size and miniature. And that wood is just great. It's just such a tight grain, light wood that allow you to do things. You know, I try to make most all of my pieces out of one piece. I don't add heads. I don't insert feathers. I try to carve them, you know, all out of one block of wood. And that's a challenge. But for me, I feel like I get a better flow. And, you know, and how my birds do. You have to remember, I mean, the anatomy, like Rich is saying, you know, people have to remember that for every action, there's a reaction. You know, and that bird turns its head around. A lot more things are going to change except from just the neck up, you know, and Rich is very skilled. I mean, I've used one of his mounts that is probably the finest mount that I've seen. Usually I don't like to go by mounts because I'm not sure just how much the taxidermists that did them. There's a lot of startup taxidermists out there, you know, but the experience that Rich has, and there's others out there that have them, you know, that you can certainly get fine references from it. And the best thing to do if you want to make a good bird is go back to the species, to the living species, to the photos and things like that.
That's why we kept aviaries.
That's right.
We both had aviaries with live mm-hmm. birds in them that we yep. could sit and observe. So it meant a lot, mm-hmm. learning colors, shapes, and attitudes.
Yeah, what about for you, Rich? I mean, is it what was it like to be where he talks about how he can do two things at once? I mean,
I have a hard time walking and chewing gum. Bennett uses a lot of Tupelo. I use Tupelo, but I also use white cedar, white pine, basswood, and I use a lot of different woods from around the world, for both inserts and for bases and for carving out of different blocks. So each carver changes a little bit. What was the question?
When you're working with the wood, are you aware of everything else going around?
Well,
or are you?
When I'm working in my shop, yeah. I listen to classical music, which you guys come in the window.
Right.
and to me, I get into a different world. You know, it's me and the wood, I enjoy, and me and the reference material. And it gets to be more of a Zen thing with me. I like to sit and work. And I like to sit and work with my hands and see something progress. And I also like to solve problems. And the best way to solve problems is create problems. So I like to do things that have a lot of different things going on. Just like Bennett was saying with a single block of wood, I do the same thing. But you create those problems, and then you've got to figure out how to get to the other side. And that's a lot of fun.
So, turning, by the way, to feathers, what kind of techniques do you use? How do you get them to be as exact? I've been over the Ward Museum, but I think you are used to, I don't know you still do, have two examples, one of a real feather and one that's not, and you got to figure out which is which, which I can never do that. But what kind of technique, how do you get them so that they really look like feathers?
Well,
or is that a secret?
the advent of the burning tool, I guess, is a big thing of it.
Mm-hmm.
The first one that I remember was Reverend Jack Drake from New Mexico showed up. And again, I'm going way back to the old Civic Center. The first time I ever seen a bird that was what we call textured today. And what he had done, just took a regular old 40-watt soldering iron and beat the tip to death until he could sharpen it like a knife blade and use that. And today we have a rheostat control. We can control the temperature and all and sharp. And then plus people are paying more attention. A lot of people, when they start out texturing a bird, the feathers look like Christmas trees. They don't look like feathers. But now they put the flow in them. They put the little splits in them and the shaft and all is there. But, and then when you go that, I mean, painting used to, I guess years ago, they used whatever they had, what they were painting their boats with, their houses with.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's all fine oils or acrylics,
or
and they just keep manipulating it until it just looks like a feather.
The feathers that you have referenced to, back then we had a competition that you had to have a real feather and then make a feather. And that guy, the feather you have reference to, is a guy who took plastic and actually formed the quill of the feather so you could actually see through it. So that he went to an extreme that way and then, made the down itself out of, I think it was floss, dental floss. We have that competition back again now at the Worlds with the feather carving, where you try to make the most lifelike feather you can. It's a real challenge to make a single feather because you don't have the rest of the bird to carry it.
So finally, David, out of all the – how many carvings, by the way, have you done, do you think?
I have no idea.
Hundreds, if not thousands, is that what you're trying to tell me?
No, it's not thousands. When I first started carving, I was numbered them. And when I got to 100, I quit numbering them.
Do you have a favorite piece that you produced, that you made, or someone that sticks out, or maybe you kept around?
The one I'm working on at the time.
Okay.
I'm telling you, you get in there. I do have pieces that have been very good to me. I've carved quail on a nest with young and broken eggs and all that stuff. I like that, but I can keep coming back to teal, green wings and blue wings. Not so much cinnamons. They're just not local here, I mean, it's it's one of those things. But like I say, my favorite piece is the one I'm working on next because I'm into it. You know, I'm gathering all the reference I can and doing all the studying and pick people's like Rich's brain. You know, it's always a help. I don't think there's any secrets in the carving world, really. I think all a good bunch.
What about you, Rich? Any particular work you did that stands out to you?
I share the opinion of an expert, but I think my biggest thing is something I have to do a lot of reference on, get in and do a lot of book work and internet work. And unlike Bennett, I keep a copious record of every bird that I produce and where it goes. And people call me, I've had people call me, you know, a bird that I did 40 years ago and ask, where is it at? You know, who where did I've got it? Where did it come from? So I can go back into my records and tell them. And I've done I'm pushing 4,000 birds now.
Wow. So
keeps me off the street now, the pool hall. There's no pool halls in Marion, so I'm not sure how that works out.
So what do you think what do you see as the future of duck carving, decoy carving? Is there changes you think going to come down the road that you can see, or is it just simply a no?
I can see a big thing right now with I've just applied for and received a Maryland Traditional Arts Program, a Master Apprentice Program. Laura was instrumental in helping with this, is that I take an apprentice under my wing for a year and work with them through this program. And what I have done is I've taken a grandfather and his grandson. So I'm getting two for one. And I think the future is bright because there's people out there who really want to learn and who want to take this and pass it on to other people. And that's one thing that the grandfather wants to do, is take it to his other grandchildren and his family. And matter of fact, I've already empowered them that they need to live through this dream and go out and teach, you know, because we want to keep this art form moving forward.
What about you, David? What do you see? Any changes in the horizon, or what do you?
Well, like I say, every year when I go to competition, I look at what, you know, just what they've thought of that they can do next, you know. But yeah, we need to keep it. We need to keep it alive. Need to keep it alive, and the award is instrumental in a lot of programs that are helping with that. I have three grandsons that carve, and my son carves, and they really like to get carving, Rick, when I'm busiest. Yeah, get out of your chair. Let me sit there and use your tools, but.
That's why you buy multiples. Huh? That's why you buy multiple tools.
Yeah, well, I'm not giving classes. I don't have any. I'm kind of rich. But no, it's you share that with them, you know, and they've got a desire. I've had my grandsons have been fortunate. I had won the A. Downer Fraser Award, which was a youth competition at the World. He won the 8-11 class as an 8-year-old, which was really,
I remember that,
really surprising. Mm-hmm. Now he's in college and has other priorities.
Yeah, my daughter won the Daniel Fraser Award too,
right?
And then promptly quit.
Laura, finally, you've got a festival coming up
this weekend.
That's right. Tell us about it.
So the Del Marvelous Festival is on May 20th at the Ward Museum, and someone named Rich Smoker will be there doing a demonstration of decoy carving with his master apprentice team, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll be there.
But it'll be a showcase of all things Del Marva that are related to cultural heritage, so including decoy making and things related to working on the water, whether that's picking crabs or working on a skipjack. There's going to be a basket making demo. There's going to be music and dance that's connected to the shore. It's basically a fun family festival that is all about local traditions.
We're speaking with Laura Bonnelli. She's the executive director of the Ward Museum of Waterfowl Art, that is also part of Salisbury University. Also, two carvers, David Bennett Scott, who actually grew up in Berlin, and also Rich Smoker, who originally grew up actually on the Susquehanna River in Pennsylvania, but is now near Crisfield. We appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thanks
for having us.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
This is a hoot.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. It's called lifelong learning. It's the idea that even if you're older, there's still room for growth. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Over the last 50 years, the idea of learning over a lifetime has changed. It's no longer just acquiring knowledge, but also skills, and it's getting out of your comfort zone. More universities are offering tuition discounted or free classes with no earned credits for these students. Mary Angela Baker is director of the university's new Center for Extended and Lifelong Learning. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
So, well, let me ask you this. How did you get into lifelong learning?
Well, I've been a lifelong learner my whole life. I started out as a child doing those Saturday trips to the library. After I graduated from college, went and worked for B. Dalton, which is a bookseller, and was store manager for 7 years. And then from there, my next career was in academia. So I went to St. Catherine University, which is located in St. Paul, Minnesota, and was part of their Continuing Education and Leadership Institute for more than 20 years. And then last year, I moved to the Delmarva area, where I'm the founding director of the Center for Extended and Lifelong Learning.
So what attracted you? What you said you got inspired? What?
Oh, lifelong learning is fabulous. It's we say that this is where curiosity thrives. When you counter people who are doing continuing education, professional development, it's different than being in school, where you have to be in school, you have to take a certain classes. These are areas of study that people want to be in. They're there for professional development or for personal enrichment.
So, and has this enriched your own life? Have you grown and with this?
Yeah.
to say the least, right?
I hope so. what is fabulous about the field I'm in is that it's very similar to books. You know what the current philosophy, the current research is on certain topics. My background is, as I said, in leadership development, so understanding how the world has changed in the last 15 to 20 years for people who are working in the business world, in profit, nonprofit, corporations, education. And then also understanding, again, as you said, that lifelong learning for people over 50 has also increased with different programs that are available for personal enrichment.
Of course, we're all like living longer. So, I mean, is this, if you get seen more and more interest in this as we kind of extend that working time that we have?
Well, the thing about learning is that this is a philosophy that should be, again, over the lifetime. So it doesn't start when you retire. Lifelong learning is happening when you're young and in school. It could happen in summer camps. I mean, we see so many children who are going to summer camps and extending their learning in a different way. The professional development part comes, you know, as people are taking charge of their career and thinking about how do I advance to the next career? How do I stay relevant? How do I stay competitive? And then as time frees up, it's saying, where's my personal enrichment? And so it's not just folks who are retired that are looking into lifelong learning. I always say that, you know, as you come into your children are out of the house, you have more free time, and you're thinking about what do I want to do, that's when a lot of people decide to go back to school.
Is this, do you find that the people are generally curious? That certainly would be one of the basis for learning, or is it just some people? And what's your experience with that?
It's a self-select.
Yeah.
So the people who are curious, they're the ones that are saying, okay, I want to learn more. I want to do, and there's all sorts of ways of doing lifelong learning, you know, everything from going to the library to get your book, going to the bookstore to get your book, or downloading on your Kindle, to being in a community of learners. And so we have, you know, the professional developments, the MOOCs, the massive online open courses that are being offered for free through many universities. That's one way of learning. At Salisbury University, we're involved in more building a community.
Mm. So, I mean, one of the things I mentioned is the idea that I think I ran across a quote. It says that when you're inside your comfort zone, you may be outside the enhancement zone.
Oh, that's fabulous.
What about that? Because we sort of learn a lot right. in our lifetimes. We get fixed in certain ruts, even if we continue to learn in that particular
right.
How important is it to get out of that comfort zone?
Well, I look at as getting out of your comfort zone and the relationship with taking a risk is being very similar. People who take risks are pushing themselves outside of that boundary. And risk-taking is different for every single person. So what's scary for me, what's risky for me, is often different than what's risky for you. Going to the South Pole for some people, is not risky. Going back to school is. And I once had a student in a class who, she was an adult learner, came back for her first time, and she told me later that the very first night of class, she sat in her desk, straight as can be, his coat zipped up, and at any point, she could leave. She told herself, at any point, I can leave, because coming back to school was risky for her. And but she put herself outside of her comfort zone. She finished her degree. She went on and had a successful career where she was able to support her family.
How much, by the way, how important is it with engagement with other people? Is it, or is it just simply that you learn skills and so on, or is it is important to have that social element, do you think?
Oh, absolutely, the social level. When you think about the six pillars of a healthy brain, obviously regular exercise, healthy diet, quality sleep, which we have so much research that says nobody gets enough of, being able to contain your stretch or manage your stress because life is stressful. You just have to learn how to deal with that. And then the two parts that really are the pillars that we work with in continuing education and lifelong learning is the mental stimulation and then an active social life. And there's a saying that Richard Leiter has, who wrote the book Life Reimagined, that isolation is fatal. And if you think about it, the people who live longest are involved in the community, however they define that community. So being connected to others is important. And being in lifelong learning, in face-to-face, or however you decide that you're connecting with people, that is very much important to your own healthy social life.
So is it important to like learn skills outside of what you normally do and to engage people outside of what of the people, for instance, that you normally engage? Do you think that's true in both areas, both engagement and what you learn, to get outside of what you normally do, getting to see new friends, new people?
Right. Yes, I do, because we are learning and growing, and we, you know, again, you're making connections both to the material, the academic content. And at Salisbury University, that's what we put front and center, that this is academic learning, and then also the connections that you're making.
So in terms of the new skills, what kind of benefits do you see people getting? I mean, obviously there's the cognitive skills, memory, that kind of thing. And is there a difference, do you think, between, on the one hand, learning new skills and yet simply, say, working, say, word puzzles or listening to classic music? There seems to be a certain passiveness as opposed to engagement there.
Well, that area I'm not an expert on, but I will tell you that for skill building, one of the most important parts when you think about continuing education, professional development, we are in such a competitive world right now. We need to make sure that our skills are up to date. Technology skills, communication skills, the number one attribute of a successful leader is how to listen. And if you don't have listening skills, then you're in trouble. And so recognizing that these are skills that you have, you know, strategic planning skills, which can borderline between leadership and management. But these skills, if you don't have them, will hurt you in the long term for your career management.
Are we being, by the way, overwhelmed by the technological changes that have occurred? I mean, and they seem to be coming so rapidly. I mean, I can remember when I was growing up, I mean, television and maybe a fax machine if they had one. But now we seem to have all these opportunities for information.
Technology
just,
fatigue.
Yeah, and just, I mean, it's not even just the information that's coming in, but then you have to learn new programs and new ways to do things as each new technological device or program comes along.
Right, and I think that a lot of times people say millennials are so much better at the change of technology. I think it's that we can all go through these technology changes. We just need to be aware of how we learn best and then finding that situation. So if you learn best sitting by yourself in front of a computer, going through the online text, that's great. But if you need to be in a class to learn those types of things, even better. Or often we call it mentor up. When you're in a work situation and you need new skills, especially around technology, you ask someone who's younger and you say, will you be my mentor and help me figure this out?
So do you find that that older people, I mean, the suggestion has been that older people have greater difficulty learning as opposed to younger people. You have any sense about that, or are we just all rushing in there?
Well, as an older person myself, I'd like to say that, yes, we can still learn it. I know that when you're younger, it's easier to learn a language skills when you're very young. So that's not an area of my expertise, but I would like to say that if you keep active, you keep engaged, that opens up so many more doors for you.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, some people suggested that there might be more wisdom the older you get.
So your wisdom is your life experiences your learning.
Mm-hmm. So tell me then a little bit about the criteria that you have in terms of the kind of retirement, that kind of thing that you look at.
Sure. And when you look at the Delmarva area, this is a destination for people who are wanting to retire. And we have many of the things that make it attractive to people. We have the healthcare quality. We have the medical center here that is accessed. The cost of living is much lower than other parts of the country. And the weather is, as we see on a day like today, it's absolutely beautiful. And so the criteria, though, also for best cities to retire is your well-being. How do you connect with your community? How are you engaged? And that is where lifelong learning comes in. So what are the programs that are available to you to bring you into a group of learners, to expand your circle of knowledge, and to just be half full of more personal enrichment?
Hmm. Do you see that those opportunities in here to reach out? Obviously,
Salisbury
you have your
University
program,
but has so many fabulous opportunities. And part of my job has been to say, what is already here? What are the great things that are going on? And where can we add on? So when we think about things that we can complement the activities already going, Panorama is a resource that's Cultural Affairs puts out. And it has several free events that are on campus that are all from, concerts to lectures to classes. The Ward Museum has so many fabulous things that are going on. So on campus already, we have very many different opportunities. And so as part of our Center for Extended Lifelong Learning, what we do is say, let's let everyone know about what's going on. So we spend time, reaching out to communities saying, this is who we are and this is what's available.
Now, a lot of people will obviously are working and older they get. What kinds of things do people look for, do you think, in a workplace or even a place in which they might not be working, they might be volunteering, they might be learning?
A general culture of the work environment? Right now, we have several, generations in the workplace.
Right.
So we have the greatest generation, which we have just a few in. We've got the baby boomers. We have Generation X, millennials. And then the next generation, which is just starting to enter the workplace, is Generation Z. And so the four things that all of those generations want is very similar. How that shows up is different. So when we come to work, we want to work that our work has meaning. What I'm doing is making a difference. We want to be able to have flexibility. And as we see with the millennials, they've really been saying flexibility is extremely important to me. I want to be able to come in. If I need to leave the workplace early, I can. If I need to come back and work, that's fine. But respect. We all want to be respected in the workplace. And finally, feedback. We want to know, again, our work has meaning, but how am I doing? I want to, even if it means coaching as a leader, that you're coaching your staff. But these four things show up differently. So respect in the workplace might look different for a boomer who says, I'm showing respect by coming in, wearing a suit and tie, being here at 8 o'clock and working till 5 o'clock. For a younger person, respect might be, well, what does it matter what I'm wearing? What does it matter what time I come in as long as the job gets done?
Mm. So in terms of learning it, For people, do people find it difficult to learn as they get older, do you think? I mean, what's your experience with it? Or does anybody stand out for you that you run into that really has really benefited from this kind of thing?
I have an example of a professor from the University of Minnesota who retired. She was in her 70s, and she joined a board for a art nonprofit. And she came in and signed up for an emerging leadership class. So right there, it's kind of this oxymoron of a 70-year-old professional signing up for a emerging leadership class. But what she said was that in academia, she never gained the skills to be part of a team. If she published alone, that was the highest praise. And so for her to learn how to be on a team was a new experience. So she was in this cohort of emerging leaders to learn the skills that would help her as she did her nonprofit work at this art nonprofit. Other examples of taking on new skills, you know, right now people have what are called bridge careers. And bridge careers is the time between you leaving your quote-unquote real career and moving into retirement. And we have more and more people who are doing this, not coming over the bridge, on this side of the bridge. But it's that connection, that time of connecting, of saying, okay, I have been doing X, Y, and Z in my professional life. I've left that. I don't want to retire yet, so I want to keep busy and do something, again, that's giving back, has meaning. And that's where the bridge career comes in saying, okay, here's some of the skills that I use, and this is how they can transfer. Entrepreneurship. 25% of all new businesses are started by people over 50. And so that's often considered a bridge career of saying, okay, I'm taking all the skills that I learned while working in my job, and now I'm applying it to my own business.
Mm-hmm. I'm reminded, as a matter of fact, because I only saw the film, that the guy who founded McDonald's was in his mid-50s.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
Yes, and he was a salesman and ran across a small hamburger stand, which was called McDonald's, was impressed with the way they actually revolutionized the delivery of hamburgers. And eventually, of course, he takes over, which is a whole other story. Maybe beware of those people who are older. I'm not sure.
Well, the nice thing about often in the bridge careers is that you have, especially, you know, there are people who retire at 55 with pensions. And so some of the financial risk has disappeared. And so they're able to say, this is what my dream job is. And I want to be able to spend the time that I can on this. And I don't have to worry so much about paying the bills.
Do you think, by the way, that older people have more confidence? That they've been around the block just more than once, and they say, okay, as opposed to, say, somebody who's younger who they're looking at that. I mean, and you can look back on your own life for that matter.
Sure. I think you get confidence, yes, life experiences, you learn from them, and you learn what's important, and you make choices about what's important. So generally, I've met a lot of fabulous women who are 50, 60, 70, and they're very comfortable with who they are.
Mm-hmm. So are there other programs that you do that you've got there?
Sure. Well, at Salisbury University, this is a brand new department. So what we're creating now is all brand new. And the programs, again, what we're focused on is programs for lifelong learning, which is the personal enrichment, the professional development and executive ed and leadership development, and then also other opportunities that they arise. So we're currently offering with the Greater Salisbury Committee a leadership program that was designed for young professionals in the Salisbury, Wicomico area. And what this program does is brings together 50 amazing young people, young people being in their 20s, 30s, 40s, and it's a way of exploring what's going on in the community, hearing from experts in the community, as well as the leadership component. And so each month we visit a different site within the county. For example, on April 20th, we'll be going to the Salisbury Water Treatment Plant, learning about that, and then bringing together a panel of people saying, what is the impact that water has in this community and its economic growth? Manufacturing, what is the impact that manufacturing has? How has it changed? And how, as young leaders, young professionals, how can we take this knowledge and as leaders move the community forward? And so the program's been endorsed by the mayor, and it features Salisbury University professors who are doing the leadership component, and then working with the Greater Salisbury Committee, having opportunities to visit these different sites and hear from panelists who know the different areas that we're visiting.
How important is that mentoring process? I mean, and it's obviously beneficial to the person who's being mentored, but what about the person who's mentoring? Do you think that
mentoring's always a two-way process? In that, yes, you're absolutely right, that there's growth that happens when with the mentee and the mentor, if it's a successful relationship. And mentoring generally works better when there's a little bit of structure around it, where there's some thought about what's happening, there's an accountability factor, and a plan. And mentoring is different than having a champion or a sponsor. So a sponsor is someone who talks about you when you're not in the room. So saying, you know what, this is a fabulous opportunity. Let's get so-and-so and let's put her in a position of leadership. So mentoring is important. Sponsorship and championship is also important.
So people who are young, who are, I say, in their 20s and 30s and so on, as I said, so what advice do you have for them in terms of trying to look ahead and to continue learning? And especially, I guess this is sort of important, particularly this day and age when, from an economic standpoint, you may have maybe four or five or six jobs in a lifetime, right. Whereas certainly with my parents, for example, World War II generation, they might have only one or maybe two.
I think it's important, first of all, to say, that whole thing about you are a company of one, to really being active in your own professional development, career development, to be aware of what your skills are, what your strengths are, and what your interests are. And from that, then continue to do the research of what's happening in that field. Great example is LinkedIn. If there's a job that you want, you should be going on to LinkedIn and saying, what are the skills that these people have in that same industry? Do I have those skills and do I need to get those skills? What keeps me competitive? How can I be taking charge of my career? And many skills that work in one industry, such as in a corporate environment, can also transfer into nonprofits, education. So it's being open-minded, knowing what the landscape is like. There are some amazing people that are out in the world that are losing their jobs. And so it really is, and through just because of budget cuts, having a whole divisions that, in 2008 we saw where just hundreds and hundreds of people lost their jobs because their whole division was cut. And so knowing that's a skill building, and then also the important component to keeping being active in your career is who is in your professional network. So who are you connecting with? Who do you know? And to build it before you need it. So, for example, I just received an email from a very good friend today who was in a senior vice president job, and her division was cut, so she'll be leaving her position. And she immediately reached out to her contacts, so friends, these are people who are friends and colleagues, and said, this is where I'm at, this is where I'm looking for, this is the type of skills I have, and these are the area of the country that I'd be willing to move to. So knowing your professional network, and networking isn't about I'm going to reach out to you and get something from you. A really good network system is where you're saying, how can I, Mary Angela, help you, Don? And then when I need it, I've already made the connection. So networking at its core is really about how can I help you? How can I help you connect to a person? Example is that I was at a restaurant the other day that's been open for a few months, met the owner of it, and said, say, have you met the director of our dining services, Owen Roston? And setting up an email between the two of them saying, I think you should meet. Owen's an amazing person, and you'll be able to learn from him.
So any final thoughts to people who are looking at lifelong learning?
Lifelong learning comes in all shapes and sizes. Again, it's the books. It's going to author readings that are being held at the university. It's taking classes. It's going online. There's so many different resources. MOOCs are a fabulous opportunity. But then again, as I would say, I'm very much the face-to-face proponent. So it's coming to Salisbury University and seeing what's available and building a community.
We've been speaking with Mary Angela Baker. She's director of the University, Salisbury University's new Center for Extended and Lifelong Learning, and we appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.